right. Well, here we are. We are on the first page of the Urantia Papers. Not the first page of the book, but first page of the Revelation. It's right there, paper number 0, section number 0, first paragraph, the foreword. And I just want to, one little comment before we actually get going. As you'll see, the Divine Counselor point out right away when we start reading, this is written by the Divine Counselor, who is chief of the Revelatory Commission that's behind Part 1. So technically, it is part of Part 1. Yeah, those three Revelatory Commissions, and this is the first of those three. But the foreword has always been placed before the title page of Part 1. Because even though it's technically, in Part 1, part of that Revelatory Commission, it's more than just a foreword to Part 1. It's meant to serve as a starting point on a journey that's quite different than any journey humans have ever taken. And just as those beings who are behind Part 1 come from a long ways removed from you and I, so you might guess that they would be writing about things that are quite removed from you and I. And they might even write in ways that are perhaps removed from you and I. That's part of the point. Part of the point is to begin to make all things new. And because of that, it does serve as a launching point for the entire Revelation. If you can begin to engage them in the foreword, then you can engage the rest of the book in the way that transcends anything that any human has ever thought of doing before the Revelation, including Part 4. Part 4 should be infinitely transcendent of anything that any human has ever thought. That's the point. There's an appropriateness to it being, right up there before Part 1's title page. Now, I'm going to ask for some patience tonight, because we're going to do something a little different. We're not, just tonight, for Section 0 and Section 1, first two sections through the four, we're going to do something a little different than our normal mode of engaging it in a back-and-forth dialogue. There'll be time at the end to engage in some questions. We're going to bring out the infinite internal ellipse at the end of the group. We want to do something different up front. What I'd like to do is, if you'll indulge me, if you'll give me just this one night of patience in this regard, I'd like to model a personal, individual study technique. Method, model. I guess you could call it guided reflection. I'd like to do that because I'd like to get people launched in as fresh a way as I can now that we're starting the book over again. And by guided reflection, I don't mean probably in the ways you initially maybe think. By guided reflection, I mean guided by your coordinated essential knowledge and your cosmic insight through the three cosmic intuitions. Now, you might say, well, what about being guided by the spirit of truth and by your thought adjuster? Yeah, that's a possibility. But remember what the revelators tell us, for those of you who have studied the book for years. The ability of the spirit of truth and your thought adjuster to help you, to guide you, is almost wholly limited by the extent to which you've already begun to guide yourself with coordinated essential knowledge and the three cosmic intuitions. If you haven't laid that foundation, there's not much they can do to engage you yet. So that's the starting point. Now, what's that like? Well, what do I mean more precisely? You're reading the book, and what you're attempting to do with this coordinated essential knowledge and your cosmic insight is to not first try to create a rational understanding of what you're reading. You want to first recognize, then rationalize. By doing that, you're putting God more first and yourself second. Because you can only recognize because of the gifts God has given you. So you want to challenge yourself to first recognize what's in front of you. And if you can't recognize anything yet, then definitely don't start rationalizing. Just keep going. Look for something you can recognize. Look for something that you can engage intuitively. Now, let's say you're going along and you have a recognition. It's a recognition that clarifies something that you've struggled with for years, maybe all your life. How do you respond to that recognition? Do you immediately turn it over to your subjective agitated mind self and have it run sideways with that recognition? Start creating a whole rational understanding. No, not first. You'll want to create a rational understanding at some point. You want to begin to develop that. But don't let yourself take you off your focus. The only reason that you could recognize is because there was a focus that the incessant clamoring of inescapable self is incapable of having. Yourself will never, self-focus. Okay? It has to be focused by your personal nature. So if you get a hold of a recognition, stay focused on that recognition. And attempt to move it up the levels of meaning. First recognition in this objective domain of the levels. Then realization, then appreciation, and then love. You want to see if you can really incorporate that recognition into your being before you race off away from it sideways. Stay focused. Maybe for a very long time. Maybe it's going to be a long time before you really get around to that, the rest of that. See if you can get some of that recognition realized before you run away from it. Because if you don't ever go from recognition to realization, you can't get to appreciation and love. The sixth level of meaning, where the word love has the meaning that they want it to have, not the painful thing that they know most people are going to think when they use that word, down there in the second level of meaning, where everyone thinks it's a feeling. Now, what if you're going along and your recognition is Oh, what they're saying there is in conflict to one of my preconceived opinions or settled ideas or long-standing prejudices. Again, do I let my self immediately rationalize that problem away? Or do I stay focused on that conflict? There's nothing more valuable to find than that conflict. Stay focused on it and try to turn up your insight. See if you can get a hold of the greater insight that's required to lift your awareness up above that conflict. Resolve that conflict. If you do, you have been revealed to. If you never have that experience, then it's not actually a revelation. It's either a flatline tone, or it's a mirror. It's an affirmation. You read it and you occasionally see your reflection in it. All those preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and long-standing prejudices will find occasional reflection points, or so it appears. Of course, those aren't real. That's a false mirror. But you'll find, your subjective consciousness will find mirrors like that. You can rationalize anything. So this is the process that you want to, when you engage it individually, personally, what you want to do. You want to model that tonight. Which means we're not going to do our normal, voicing out, in the group. What we're going to do tonight instead, we're not going to do any question answer during, as we go through these first two sections. Question and answers we'll do when we're done. Okay, what I'd like to do is, if you'll allow me the patience here, is I'm going to read it. And I'm going to voice my reflections. My reflections as a brand new reader, for instance. I'll definitely start out in that mode. As I go along, occasionally I'll bring in the reflections of a more longtime reader. But I'd like you to just listen to that and think about, you'll probably have a number of thoughts. Don't let yourself carry you away from the focus. Don't try to voice those thoughts. Reflect on them. Practice, be staying in that focus point until you actually get a hold of something solid that feels different than all the things that you've ever gripped before. The things that tend to constantly need to be spoken of in order for you to keep a hold of them. Okay? Those are subjective, adjudant things. Objective, personal, real things stay. They're there. Once they're there forevermore. Because something that's real is something that's wrapped around the infinite eternally lives. It's eternal. You've eternalized it if it's real. And it will always be there for you. That's what you're attempting to do, to acquire what they're saying in that sort of a way. Okay. So let's try this. In the minds of the mortals of your rancha, that being the name of your world, there exists great confusion respecting the meaning of such terms as God, divinity, and deity. Human beings are still more confused and uncertain about the relationships of the divine personalities designated by these numerous appellations. Because of this conceptual poverty associated with so much ideational confusion, I have been directed to formulate this introductory statement in explanation of the meanings which should be attached to certain word symbols, as they may be hereinafter used
in those papers which the Orvinton Corps of Truth Revealers have been authorized to translate into the English language of Urantia. Okay, so I had enough courage to open this book and I started reading it. And I see the very first thing that this author is doing is saying that there's great confusion. There's still more confused and uncertain thoughts. There's conceptual poverty and so much ideational confusion. What's he doing here? Seems like he's laying a challenge just right out front. This is how he sees me. Do I have the courage to see myself that way? Do I have the courage to face my facts? That I'm great confusion. I'm still more confused and uncertain. I have conceptual poverty and so much ideational confusion. Well, I guess if I can't face that fact, maybe I should just stop at the first paragraph here. Makes it nice and clean that he said that right up front, so I didn't waste a lot of time. Okay, I'll bite. What does he say next? It is exceedingly difficult to present enlarged concepts and advanced truth in our endeavor to expand cosmic consciousness and enhance spiritual perception when we are restricted to the use of a circumscribed language of the realm. But our mandate admonishes us to make every effort to convey our meanings by using the word symbols of the English tongue. We have been instructed to introduce new terms only when the concept to be portrayed finds no terminology in English, which can be employed to convey such a new concept partially or even with more or less distortion of meaning. Okay, so kind of repeating himself. He says it's going to be exceedingly difficult if I keep reading. And I noticed something right away here. He says that there's an endeavor to expand cosmic consciousness and enhance spiritual perception. He seems to be distinguishing between cosmic and spiritual. I always thought those were kind of synonyms. I wonder what's up with that. Now, as a longtime reader, I reflect, yes, the purpose of the revelation is to reveal truth and coordinate essential knowledge in order to expand cosmic consciousness and enhance spiritual perception. But as a brand new reader, I see that he's saying that the way he thinks about things is in some way vastly different than the way I think about things. And he's calling the way I think a circumscribed language. So yeah, it does sound like it may be exceedingly difficult here to try to wrap my mind around what he's trying to give me here. And very interesting. So he says that he was instructed that if he could find an English word that's already been coined, he's got to use that, even if it introduces more or less distortion of meaning, before he'll coin a word. Well, that's kind of curious. Because right up in the very first sentence, he coined a word, Urantia. Well, let's see. What knowledge do I have about that? Oh, yeah, that would literally mean your heavenly place. your place in the heavens. Huh. So I've always thought of where I live as Earth, or the Earth. No capital E. Just, you know, the dirt I stand on, that's where I live. But that even goes beyond more distortion of meaning. I don't live on a ball of dirt. I have a place in the heavens. Okay, I'm starting to get a little intrigued. Okay, what does he say next? In the hope of facilitating comprehension and of preventing confusion on the part of every mortal who may peruse these papers, we deem it wise to present in this initial statement an outline of the meanings to be attached to numerous English words which are to be employed in designation of deity and certain associated concepts of things, meanings, and values of universal reality. Okay, so first thing there, he's having to hope. That I can take up this exceedingly difficult challenge. Because he says that every mortal who peruses these papers and doesn't take up this exceedingly difficult challenge will fail to find the truth that he hopes he can reveal. And I notice he seems to be starting to get going here on something too. So he says there's a universal reality, and it has a threefold nature: things, meanings, and values. Well, if that's kind of really the very first thing that he would tell me, besides how limited I am and how difficult this is going to be, that is probably something extremely fundamental to being able to understand what he and all the other authors are going to say throughout the entire Revelation. I'll try to definitely keep that in mind. Things, meanings, and values. Okay, what else does he say? But in order to formulate this foreword of definitions and limitations of terminology, it is necessary to anticipate the usage of these terms in the subsequent presentations. This foreword is not, therefore, a finished statement within itself. It is only a definitive guide designed to assist those who shall read the accompanying papers dealing with deity and the universe of universes, which have been formulated by an Orvinton commission sent to Urantia for this purpose. Wow, this is really interesting. He seems to be very revealing. So he seems to be telling me here that, you know, he's gonna lay this out, but he doesn't lay any claims that he's coordinated with every single author. You know, even in this first part, well, I wonder if I'm going to be able to see that there's kind of breaks in the integrity of the book then, if they seem to all be just sort of being set loose to write their, you know, their particular paper. I wonder if it's really going to come together. But I'm starting to see some interesting details here too. He uses this term universe of universes. That reminds me of something I've heard. That reminds me of that phrase, heaven of heavens. I wonder if that's purposeful. I wonder if he's purposely trying to draw a parallel there. Interesting. And wow, look at this. He says that this commission that he's part of was actually here. They came to our planet. Well, that's pretty cool. Wonder how far they had to journey. How many were there? Was that a difficult thing? They probably had to go out of their way quite a bit. That's kind of cool. I'm feeling like they, they're making an effort on my part here. Well, now this is interesting. Before I go on, I see that there's a gap here, a larger gap between the paragraphs. That must be indicating something. Maybe he's going to shift gears a little bit here or something. Well, let's see what he says. Your world, Urantia, is one of many similar inhabited planets which comprise the local universe of Nebadon. This universe, together with similar creations, makes up the super universe of Orvinton, from whose capital, Uversa, our commission hails. Orvinton is one of the seven evolutionary super universes of time and space, which circle the never-beginning, never-ending creation of divine perfection, the central universe of Havona. At the heart of this eternal and central universe is the stationary Isle of Paradise, the geographic center of infinity, and the dwelling place of the eternal God. Wow. I think that's the most amazing thing I've ever read. I've never read anything that was even remotely similar to that. I mean, the way he's talking about things, it's rather astonishing. And look at what he said. He said that this planet is one of many inhabited planets. I've always kind of entertained the notion that there might be other inhabited planets. That's kind of cool. And he says that they're in some grouping that he calls a local universe, and ours is named Nebadon. And then there's a bunch of those groupings that are in bigger groupings that are called super universes. There's capitals. Oh, it's just like states and countries. He says they're evolutionary. But wait a minute. He said something I didn't quite pick up the first time there. He said they were creations, not formations. Well, I've always thought of things that were created as being God snapping his fingers, and there they are. But he's calling them creations and evolutionary. That's really different than anything I've ever read before. Huh. Oh, and then... now I can, I'm starting to feel something here. I'm thinking about this. He's talking about a universe of divine perfection, something that was created perfect. Wow, I've always wished that I lived in a place like that. Wouldn't that be cool? And apparently this perfect universe it's in the center. There's some vast organization to the whole universe, apparently, because he's saying this is in the center. I never thought of looking at the universe that way. I mean, I've never heard any scientists talk about the universe like that, like it was somehow organized on a grand scale. And then look what he says. He says that just like I have a core of my being, I have a heart. The entire universe has a heart. That's pretty powerful. And he says that at that geographic heart, that place at the center, there's a thing that he's calling the Isle of Paradise. And apparently God actually stands there. He doesn't float somewhere. He's apparently standing right there. And from there, he reaches all the way out to infinity. Okay, I think I'm pretty hooked on this book already. That's pretty remarkable. I'm already feeling satisfied in a way that I couldn't even imagine when I started here just a few paragraphs back. What else does he say? The seven evolving super universes, in association with the central and divine universe, we commonly refer to as the grand universe. These are the now organized and inhabited creations. They are all a part of the master universe, which also embraces the uninhabited but mobilizing universes of outer space. Oh, I'm starting to see. So the thing that we always call universe, they're calling the master universe. And look at that. Okay, so he's saying it's just the central part that's inhabited. The whole outer part is uninhabited yet. Wow, that's really different than my favorite science fiction shows where everything is inhabited everywhere. Huh. It all has a heart with God at the center. Very intriguing. Okay, so what's his first section here? Deity and divinity. Deity? Now, wait a minute. I thought he said at the center of everything was God. And I can see over here, section two is God. If that's the center, why doesn't he start with God? Huh. Well, that's curious. Well, I mean, deity and God are kind of synonyms. Maybe it doesn't really mean anything. Well, let's see what he says. The universe of universes presents phenomena of deity activities on diverse levels of cosmic realities, mind meanings, and spirit values. But all of these ministrations, personal or otherwise, are divinely coordinated. Okay, well, so this universe of universes he was talking about, he's saying is apparently really, really complex. I see he's got three things again he's mentioning here: cosmic realities, mind meanings, and spirit values. He's saying I need to start thinking about lots of levels. Okay, and there's personal and impersonal. Oh, but wait a minute. In the context here, he's saying that these ministrations, these phenomena of deity activities. Okay, so some deity activities are not personal? Huh. That's really... Okay, how am I supposed to think about that? Not impersonal or whatever, deity activities. Is he saying that there's deity and sometimes it's not personal? Maybe that's what he's saying. Okay, but I like this last thing he says. He's saying that it's divinely coordinated. I like that. That feels good to know. My spiritual consciousness is pleased to hear that. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's why he's used that word cosmic twice. That's right. The word cosmic means universal harmony. Divinely coordinated. That's why he used that word. Oh, I'm starting to see here. He's very sneaky. He's choosing his words really carefully. Okay, so he wanted me to think divinely coordinated already. Okay, now it's sunk in. Now I get it. Okay. All right, what does he say? Oh, look, he's got an all cal. Okay, he must be going to define it here now, really. Okay. Deity is personalizable as God, is pre-personal and super-personal in ways not altogether comprehensible by man. Deity is characterized by the quality of unity, actual or potential, on all supermaterial levels of reality. And this unifying quality is best comprehended by creatures as divinity. Okay, so unity is the big thing. And look, it's right there. Okay, so he's saying that deity is this thing he's calling deity that he's defining here is something that's antecedent to God. something more primal than God. And when it's personalized, apparently you call it God, personalizable as God. But sometimes it's apparently in a mode where it's pre-personally must means it's going to eventually be personalized, I guess is what he means by that. And super personal, so in other words, somehow it must go totally beyond any personality thing that I can comprehend. Okay, so like maybe he's even saying that it's, you know, like just never personal at all. Oh, well, yeah, okay, he really kind of said that up there before. That's right, he said personal or otherwise. So apparently there's some deity that's just not personal at all. Well, that's really different. Now, he's saying that the fundamental quality here is unity. Okay, well, now, if I want to think about deity and God different, and I always have, and I've always used it kind of as a substitute for God, and God, I think of as being a being that I could point to somewhere. If deity is fundamentally unity, and he's obviously telling me we're going to talk about different flavors of deity or something here. He's saying it's really complicated. I should probably try to think of some way to think about this where, it's somehow I can talk about separateness, but it's still fundamentally unity. What way could I talk about it? I could think of it as a single object that has facets, like a giant crystal with many facets, many faces. It's still one, but maybe that would work. Maybe each facet would be a different flavor or whatever of deity, but it's all unity. It's all one thing. Maybe that'll help me as I go forward. Let's try that out. Okay, and he's saying that apparently divinity, he definitely doesn't want to use that for a substitute for God. It's apparently just when you're talking about the quality part of it. Okay. All right, so what does he say next here? Deity functions on personal, pre-personal, and super-personal levels. Total deity is functional on the following seven levels. Okay, so he's definitely repeating this personal, pre-personal, super-personal thing. He wants to drive that home. And that's kind of interesting. You know, I always think of God as acting. I bet he purposely didn't use the word acting. He said functions, deity functions. He's probably wanting to tease those two apart, differentiating between deity and God. Okay, and there's definitely different aspects to it, or parts, or whatever word, or facets. Because he's talking about total. So if I think about all of the facets, and they're functioning, apparently on seven basic levels. Okay, well, what are these levels called? Let's see. They're one, static, self-contained, and self-existent deity; two, potential, self-willed, and self-purposive deity; three, associative, self-personalized and divinely fraternal deity; four, creative, self-distributive and divinely revealed deity; five, evolutional, self-expansive and creature-identified deity. Creature-identified deity. Okay, so apparently he's saying, I was kind of wondering where in the heck I fit into all this. This is like really complicated. Okay, so the fifth level apparently is where I am, and that's where deity identifies with me as a creature. That's where it engages me. Evolutional. Okay, I'm an evolutionary creature. Okay. Okay, so that's apparently where I am. Okay, six, supreme, self-experiential and creature creator unifying deity. Deity functioning on the first creature identificational level as time-space over-controllers of the grand universe, sometimes designated the supremacy of deity. Okay, new reader is getting a little lost here. I wonder what the reflections of a longtime reader might be. Okay, so supreme. Okay, so if the evolution level's where I am, that's the finite level. Oh yeah, okay, and I know from the Universal Levels of Reality paper that I have seven levels. I've got the finite level, and then above that I have the supreme level, and then above that I have the absonite level, and then above that I have the ultimate level, and then above that I have the co-absolute level, and then above that I have the absolute level, and then on top I've got the infinite level. Okay, so he's saying we're going from the finite level up to the supreme level, and that supreme level, yeah, I've started to figure some of that out now as a longtime reader. I know that when I think about that supreme level from the bottom up point of view, I know that I can think of that supreme level as sort of the maximum finite, the total finite. But if I look at it from the top down point of view, that supreme level is the minimum absonite level. At the same time that it's the maximum finite, it's the minimum absonite. Oh yeah, and we just read that last week too, didn't we? Yeah, I remember when they were talking about the Creator Son finishing his seven bestowals and becoming a Master Son. They said, in the experience of descending from God to man, Michael was concomitantly experiencing the ascent from partiality of manifestability to supremacy of finite action and finality of the liberation of his potential for absonite function. From the bottom-up point of view, he's getting up to supremacy, the total finite. From the top-down point of view, he's beginning to function at the minimal level of the absonite. Oh yeah, and they said, Michael, a creator son is a time-space creator. The bottom-up point of view, he's a creator son from the bottom-up point of view. But Michael, a sevenfold master son, now he has a top-down point of view. A sevenfold master son is a member of one of the divine cores constituting the Trinity ultimate. Yeah, that's right. We talked about that. That's why Gavalia purposely said Trinity ultimate, not ultimate Trinity, so he used the unity viewpoint designation, the top down point of view, because one of the cores in that Trinity ultimate are the architects of the master universe. Those are absonite beings. If the other two cores, the supreme creators and the supreme being, are going to engage the architects at their level, they've got to have at least the minimal absonite functioning going on, or the two are not going to meet. That's right. We figured that all out. That's exactly what's going on in this picture. So just like the Master Son has some absonite functioning, that's that whole evolving supreme being. He's not only from a bottom-up point of view, you know, at the total finite, from the top-down point of view, he's an absonite individual. He's functioning there with the architects and the master sons and the creative mother spirits. Okay. Yep. Yeah, that's really clear. I definitely understand where I am in this picture here now. Okay, so the seventh level, the ultimate, self-projected and time-space transcending deity. Deity omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent. Deity functioning on the second level of unifying divinity expression as effective over-controllers and absonite upholders of the master universe. As compared with the ministry of the deities to the grand universe, this absonite function in the master universe is tantamount to universal over-control and super-sustenance, sometimes called the ultimacy of deity. Oh, yeah, okay, I see they're purposely repeating something here, too. Yeah, they want to really get me to see this. Okay, yeah, he said that that this was functioning relative to the finite, and this is functioning relative to the absonite. Yep, so they, you have the ultimate above the absonite and the supreme above the finite. And and he's reminding us that we're not, that I'm not self sustaining here. There's a whole sustenance thing going on. And I know, and absonite upholders, I know who the absonite upholder is. Capital A, capital U. That's God the ultimate, functioning as God the Mother. That's the absolute upholder. Okay, yeah. I definitely, as a longtime reader here, I've begun to put those pieces together. I clearly see, what he's doing here, even right here at the beginning of the book. Okay, all right. So what else does he say here? Oh, wait a minute. That's right. That last thing he said, that was he had a pattern there, didn't he? He said supremacy of deity and ultimacy of deity. Oh, yeah, and wait a minute. That passage I just went back and looked at, and in the seven bestowals, they used supremacy, but that had a lowercase s. And here it's an uppercase s. Oh, yeah, that's right. I remember I've thought about that. That supremacy of deity, that functioning of deity on the supreme level, that's a proper noun, that's an uppercase S. Same way with ultimacy. I see the rest of the terms, even though I don't know exactly what all these other levels are about. I know how to talk about the functioning of deity on those levels. So the functioning of deity on the fifth level would be the evolutionality of deity. And then there's the creativity of deity and the associativity of deity and the potentiality of deity and the stasis of deity. All capital letters. And it's really clear here. It's a functioning of deity on that level. This is deity and divinity. And he said that's just when you're talking about the quality of it. Oh, so the divinity of capital S supremacy is the common noun supremacy, the lowercase s. That's the divinity of the functioning of deity on the sixth level. Okay, that's really cool. They're very precise. That's really helpful. Okay, yeah, so here, oh yeah, here he's talking about the levels. The finite level of reality is characterized by creature life and time-space limitations. Finite realities may not have endings, but they always have beginnings. They are created. The deity level of supremacy may be conceived as a function in relation to finite existences. Oh, yeah, see, right there it is. He just says it point blank. So I was thinking up there. Yeah, all right, definitely. He doesn't say it's functioning, as a finite existence. It's functioning in relation to finite existences. Yep. It's the notch above the finite. It's that both maximum finite and minimum absonite at the same time. So as you cross that boundary, you go into the absonite level of reality. It's characterized by things and beings without beginnings or endings and by the transcendence of time and space. Absoniters are not created. They are eventuated. They simply are. The deity level of ultimacy connotes a function in relation to absonite realities. No matter in what part of the master universe, whenever time and space are transcended, such an absonite phenomenon is an act of the ultimacy of deity. Yep, there it is again. So, I hadn't actually thought about it all the way up at that level. So I've got that boundary there. So it's sort of the you can think of the ultimate as being the final absonite, the top of the absonite, or from the top-down point of view, it's that foundation of the co-absolute. Oh, yeah, yeah, and there's that other experiential trinity. Yeah, they were talking about, they refer to that. That's right, the first level and the second level. Yeah, they were alluding to those trinities up there in 6 and 7. Yeah, that second experiential trinity where I've got the God, the Supreme God, the Ultimate, and the Consummator of Universe Destiny. Yeah, I see the obvious parallel. So the Consummator of Universe Destiny is a co-absolute individual. And in order to get up to function with Him, God the Supreme and God the Ultimate have to have achieved that minimum co-absolute functioning to engage the Consummator of Universe Destiny. Okay, so then we're up there. The absolute level is beginningless, endless, timeless, and spaceless. For example, on Paradise, time and space are non-existent. The time-space status of Paradise is absolute. This level is Trinity attained, existentially, by the Paradise deities, but this third level of unifying deity expression is not fully unified experientially. Whenever, wherever, and however the absolute level of deity functions, Paradise absolute values and meanings are manifest. Oh yeah, this absolute level, that's a lot more complicated. Yeah, it doesn't fit immediately into the seven levels up there. Yeah, there isn't an eighth level. It's called the absolute. Yeah, I've thought about that absolute level a lot as a longtime reader. There's a lot of complexities to that. This whole bit about how it's attained existentially, it's not fully unified experientially. Yeah, that's that whole complicated thing about existential experiential deity. When we get up there to the absolute level, the absolute upholder. Oh yeah, and this last sentence. Yeah, when we bring out the infinite eternal ellipse, we're definitely going to have to show how easy it is to understand that last statement about how, however the absolute level of deity functions, Paradise absolute values and meanings are manifest. Why is it that Paradise gets into the act so definitively there? You know, and even as a pretty immature reader, you know, I was already starting to think, you know, of finite and absonite and a sequence, and I get to the absonite and I leave the finite behind, and there's no absonite until you're done with the finite. But, you know, right here he's pointing out that even when you're, you know, on the absolute level. Oh, yeah, that's right. He even said that up there. That's right. I kind of didn't notice that. Yeah, whenever time and space are transcended, such an absonite phenomenon is the act of the ultimacy of deity. Ah, so he's saying in both places that even now in the finite, you can definitely have something that's in the absonite, in the absolute. You don't have to leave the whole finite behind. So yeah, I mean, that makes complete sense as a longtime reader. Because I know that those two experiential trinities are functioning right now. You know, and that's how it's happening. You know, there's that little bit of minimal absoniteness to the Supreme Being and minimal absoniteness to the Master Sons. And, there's still definitely time and space, and we're a long ways from the grand universe settled enlightened life, but that's already happening right now. It's a win ever for sure. Okay. Deity may be existential, as in the eternal Son, experiential, as in the Supreme Being, associative, as in God the Sevenfold, undivided, as in the Paradise Trinity. Okay, so as a pretty new reader here, So he's really emphasizing this, that on the one hand you have existential deity, and on the other hand you have experiential deity. And he's mentioning some names that, you know, I'm not quite sure who he's referring to. I've heard people talk about God as the supreme being before. The eternal son, I'm not sure, quite sure what he's talking about there. And then he says, yeah, it must be apparently really complicated too, because somehow it's not just existential and experiential. Somehow the two get associated together in something called God the Sevenfold, whatever that is. And then undivided. Okay, so there's something about the Paradise Trinity. Well, I mean, when I've learned about the Trinity growing up in church, the Trinity was an association of three persons. That doesn't really sound like undivided. It sounds like something different. Well, but they always kind of say, yes, but even though they're three, they're one. So maybe he just means it like that, you know, just kind of figuratively. But as a longtime reader, like, wait a minute now, I know there's nothing fuzzy about that. He's talking about the top-down point of view there. The bottom-up point of view, I've got the three absolute persons. I've got the universal Father, the eternal Son, and the infinite Spirit. And the superadditive consequence of the relationship between the three is the Paradise Trinity. That's coming together. When he says undivided, that's top-down point of view. That's where I have it all together. And there's three parts that I can divide out: the universal Father, the eternal Son, and the infinite Spirit. And the part that's undivided, undividable, the part that really is kind of antecedent to the three gods, part that's just deity, not personalized deity, yeah, that's the Paradise Trinity, undivided, that I really can understand from my top-down point of view now. Deity is the source of all that which is divine. Deity is characteristically and invariably divine. But all that which is divine is not necessarily deity, though it will be coordinated with deity and will tend towards some phase of unity with deity, spiritual, mindful, or personal. Now, yeah, that last part, spiritual, mindful, or personal, he said right up front there, we were talking about supermaterial. Those are the three things that are most immediately supermaterial. Now, as a beginning reader here, I noticed something. Deity is the source of all that which is divine. So if I start thinking of myself as divine, that's a pretty strong thing to think. He's saying that I can't just imagine that somehow I've bootstrapped myself to being divine. I'm self-divinizing. Yeah, I only get that because I have some connection to deity. Now, obviously, he says if sometime in the future I ever am worthy of the label divine, that doesn't make me deity. Yeah, and that's pretty obvious. I know I'm not deity. I'm not even divine. But he is telling me that I will be coordinated with deity. I wonder what that means. Well, as a longtime reader, yeah, I know how that works. When I make it to the Isle of Paradise, and I'm a finaliter, I'm not a creator, but I am a trinitizer. I am very much coordinated with deity. I'm a bit more than merely a creature then. I'm a trinitizer. I can give rise to creature trinitized sons. First time readers, I was hoping he'd say a little bit more about divinity. Divinity is the characteristic, unifying, and coordinating quality of deity. Well, that's kind of just what he said before. So I guess apparently that's just kind of it. When I'm talking about, I'm just focusing on the quality of deity, either the quality that deity has because it's deity, or because something has become so related to deity that it takes on that quality even though it isn't deity. That's divinity. Divinity is creature comprehensible as truth, beauty, and goodness, correlated in personality as love, mercy, and ministry, disclosed on impersonal levels as justice, power, and sovereignty. Wow, that's really cool. I've thought about truth, beauty, and goodness a lot of times, those great qualities. And I see how he's getting me to think. There's obviously some more threefoldness there. He's bringing in love, mercy, ministry. Love, that way that works. I can feel that, how that starts with love and goes to mercy. Yeah, that's right. You know, mercy, my knowledge, I remember, mercy is the exercise of love. And you put it in action, love, mercy, ministry. Wow, that's just so clear when you think about it like that. And justice, power, and sovereignty, that's there too. It's not all just the personal part. The impersonal part is right there too, and it can be divine also. Boy, I'm really liking this new picture that he's forming here. I'm thinking back. I'm thinking about how he started me out here as a new reader. You know, he kind of sobered me up. Then he had a break in a big paragraph break, and then he had three little paragraphs that were really powerful. And I see it now as I reflect back on it. He sort of challenged me to have the courage. And then he did something really cool. In those three little paragraphs, he basically poked a pin in every preconceived opinion, settled idea, and long-standing prejudice that I had. He wiped my slate clean. And then as soon as he did that, look at that, right after those three paragraphs, then he jumps in to the first definition, you know, and started to try to reform me, started to try to reveal to me. Wow, that's really cool the way he did that. And as I'm reflecting on this, I totally trust him to do that. I mean, he's speaking to me in the first person here. I feel like I know this being already. This is really cool. Reform me some more. What else can you do? I want some more things on my once blank slate, because boy, it doesn't feel blank anymore, and it feels like it's got something on it now that's alive. I can already feel. I bet I can do something with what you've given me already. Can you show me an example of how I could start to really put this into practice? Little aside. This list of seven that's at the end here. Little coordinated essential knowledge is coming into my reflection here. That list of seven is basically taken right out of a book by a person we've talked about a number of times over the years, Charles Hartshorne. Sort of the guy, you know, launching process theology. He basically has these seven bullet points like this in there. If you look at them, the one thing that you'll notice right away, Charles listed the seven in very mechanical fashion. The Revelators reworded a little bit so it isn't quite so mechanical in construct. And you'll also notice that Charles wrote that book in 1941. Ah, so this is one of those little things that was added in the third phase of bringing the revelation into existence. after 1935. It's almost like, oh, I asked the question, and guess what? Someone else must have too. It sure would be nice if you'd show me an example of how I could use what you've told me right away here, right at the beginning. Show me an example of how I can take something that a human has said and make it new. Yeah. I remember reading that stuff that Charles Hartshorne wrote. Guy was struggling. He was trying. I'll give him that much. He at least could see that it was pretty limited to think in pure dichotomies, like perfect and imperfect. He was trying. He was thinking, well, okay, all we've got though is the plane. And on one side it's perfect, and on the other side it's imperfect. Well, there is the line that divides the two halves of the plane. I could call that line something. I could call that relative. So I'd have perfect and relative and imperfect. Oh, and then, I've got three things. I can use my mathematics. I could generate the seven combinations of those three things, and I could list them, and I could say, at least we, those of us who want to think about God, we could try to somehow do it with these seven thoughts in mind, these seven, enumerations of this notion, this sort of upstepped dichotomy that I'm thinking about. So that's where Charles Hartshorne was. What does the divine counselor do with that little presentation that Charles made? So he says, divinity may be perfect. Oh, right away, deep parenthetical, M dashes. Well, why don't you try complete? Why don't you try the word complete instead of perfect? So that it's complete and incomplete and relative. Okay, so divinity may be perfect, complete, as on existential and creature and creator levels of paradise perfection. Yeah, very much top-down sort of stuff. Yeah, that's going to be complete. I might even go ahead and use the word perfect for that. Existential creator. It may be imperfect. It may be incomplete. As on experiential and creature levels of time-space evolution. Oh, yeah, bottom up. Top-down and the bottom up. Or it may be relative, neither perfect nor imperfect, neither complete nor incomplete. As on certain Havona levels of existential experiential relationships. Ah, there's that existential experiential thing again. I've thought about that some. Like in Havona, you've got a part of Havona that's bottom up and incomplete. And you've got a part of Havona that's top down and complete. Oh, yeah. Wait a minute. Oh, of course. That's right. Right before he's doing this, he gave me finite, absonite, absolute. And he's giving me this Charles Hartshorne example in the context of divinity. I see what he wants me to do. When we attempt to conceive of perfection or completeness in all phases and forms of relativity, we encounter seven conceivable types. Let's not just read the touched up Charles Hartshorne. Let's do what the divine counselor wants us to do here. Let's put it all together. Let's use what he's just taught us. Absolute divinity in all aspects, number one. Number two, absolute divinity in some phases, and absonite perfection in all other aspects. Absolute, absonite, and finite aspects in varied association. absolute divinity in some respects, finite in all others. Absolute divinity in no direction, absinite divinity in all other manifestations. Or if you don't, if you have the typo taken out, in all manifestations. Little typo in that line. Six, absolute divinity in no phase, absinite in some, finite in others. And finally, absolute divinity in no attribute, finite in all. Okay, thank you for for giving me that luxury there to do it like that. So, and I, you know, and let's start a little conversation here now, kind of more in our normal mode. You see that, you know, one of the first things he did is, you know, because we all know not only are they not allowed to use, to coin a word, if they can find any word that's already been coined that at least only has more distortion of meaning attached to it, they've got to use that word. You know, it's the same way in the, you know, beyond coining words. You know, if they can find something that any human has written, quite, maybe even extensive, that they can basically use, they have to do that. Here's an example, you know, of doing that, okay? But the point is not to engage it as a fact finder, where all you see initially as a new reader is a bullet point of dead facts, you know, seven bullet points of dead facts. And then as you maybe, you know, have someone tell you, well, you know, that comes from a human source work. You know, and it's basically just a direct restatement, nothing really added. And you're going, well, okay, well, why in the heck is it even in there? You know, and if I'm really getting negative in my fact finder mode, you know, I'm starting to spiral down into the abyss here in my relationship to this book. Now, see, notice what I did with it. That's what the Divine Counselor wants you to do. He wanted to give you an example of how to do this, you know. And if you challenge yourself, just like I did, whenever you come upon something like that, you do the same thing. Don't just stay there with the dead words. If you have a living, truthful relationship with the book, you can see objectively what's going on. He wants me to put this all together. He wants me to go beyond what's just there in black letters on a white page. Okay, he wants me to read it the way I read it, you know, where then I can start to think about, whoa, so as I go through the book, I could really, you know, all you talk about all these different things, you know, I could think about, well, does that thing have absolute divinity in some respects, you know, and finite in all others? Okay. Yeah. I mean, I know, you know, once I've developed a relationship with the truth of this, you know, even before I get out of the foreword, I find this, I know that dichotomy is one of the greatest falsehoods that I have to break, that to think of everything as perfect and imperfect. If you still think that, that's just an abomination to the revelation. The very first things that he does is try to challenge you out of that flatlander mode that Charles Hartshorne was in. You know, where, you know, you're trying to let go of perfect imperfect, but you're a flatlander. You can't let go of it, you know. And so you just rationalize. You make it more complicated in that flatland, you know. No, go up, and only if you begin to have an objective consciousness, relationship to truth, can you go up and can you see what he's trying to do here. Yeah, you know, that it's a great example of that. I think you had something you want to bring in.
So. I apologize if I'm not following.
No. We're in the mode now. Yeah.
But you know, I think, you know, one of our friends and a reader of the book, or at least for a while back, you know, identified Charles Hartshorne mm-hmm. quite a while ago, and I think contributed to the guy who wrote the book, I forget his name, Martin Gardner.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you're basically saying that those are the imperfect, those are Hartshorne's words.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, go read Hartshorne's words.
And
yeah,
that's
yeah,
why
yeah.
you put so much emphasis on the introduction, saying that more or less distortion of meaning. You use yeah. that quite a bit.
Right.
So they used what was in existence, but then they're trying to lift us up from there.
Yeah, and see, and I really try to stress, I mean, when you talk about more, if you take this just at fact finder face value and say, this book says that the truth of me as a finite creature is that I am imperfect, that's an abomination. You know, you've heard me speak to that. You are perfecting. You know, Havona is perfect. You are perfecting. And the super additive consequence of the relationship between that which is perfect and that which is perfecting is that which is perfected. There is no relationship of anything to that which is imperfect. Imperfect is the absence of something. A relationship is between some things. It's utterly illogical. You know, it's most unfortunate factually to think of imperfect as somehow being some fact that you're going to understand. It's the absence of fact. You know, what you are is that which is perfecting. And you've got to, you know, there's a reason why this is the example he puts up first. That's the first thing you want to break out. Don't ever think of yourself as imperfect again. Okay? You are good because you're perfecting. If you want to have a relationship between truth, beauty, and goodness, okay, you go, well, okay, goodness means perfect. Wow, this is like, how am I going to be perfect? It goes nowhere. Okay? Okay? Out here in the seven super universes, in the super universe level, that which is perfecting is that which is good. That's the definition of goodness out here. If you're moving, there's goodness. If you're progressing, perfecting, and harmonizing, you're good. If you're a parked car, if the truth is not in you, you're dead. Yeah, there's no goodness. It's just think about, you know, I mean, I can't think of anything more contrasting. And they put it right up front where a new reader is nowhere near ready to think about all that Charles Hartshorne objective perspective. Wow, that's pretty interesting. But see, he told you that it's going to be exceedingly difficult and that every single person who doesn't take up that challenge is going to immediately, catastrophically fail in the effort. You know, it's, you know, you'll get abomination, you know, in your head by, you'll start to preach that the fifth epical revelation says that out in the super universe level, we're imperfect, that's the truth of us. No.
Repeat to us what that challenge is, to take up that challenge that they say we will fail if we don't take up that challenge.
The challenge to get in that mode where before you allow your second adjutant to create any horizontal breadth, you've got to rock solid, recognize what is being revealed. Recognize how it is. It's literal revelation. It does not exist anywhere in all of human history, extant or otherwise. It is utterly transformative. You've got to recognize that. You have to have the courage to let it completely reform you. If you are still afraid of having something within you change, okay, you can't get there. You have to have the courage, courageous and independent cosmic thinking. You have to have the courage to trust, not just have faith, Not just that initial faint flicker of faith. You have to have grown faith into trust. Like the first thing I've got to do is once I get past those three little paragraphs where he wiped my slate clean, I've got to trust him to not fill it full of garbage. Okay? I've got, you know, I'm trusting him to reform me. All things become new. You know, I'm going to let him have me. Okay? And like I said, the precursor to that, you know, you've got to get in the mode where you've begun to master yourself. You know, lessons in self-mastery way up there in Jesus' papers, for instance. You have to start this. It's why the first time Jesus introduces the kingdom of heaven, he uses that term with his apostles, and he's trying to give them a definition of what he means by kingdom of heaven. You know, over the course of his public ministry, he says many things under the banner of kingdom of heaven. That's why it takes a whole paper to talk about it eventually in the Jesus papers, okay? But the very first time he introduces it, when he's just starting to get going with the apostles, he ties only one thing to the expression kingdom of heaven. It's not the Spirit of truth. It's not thought of jesters. It's the Holy Spirit. Okay? You have to start there. You have to first have a coordinated essential knowledge in your, you know, skull. And you have to have discovered your ability to have an objective perspective, to have insight. Because those are your three recognition mechanisms. You know, if you go to paper 16, section 6, you know, you see how they talk about them as being, you know, like the third cosmic intuition, your spiritual insight that allows you to recognize value. Without that, there would not be the word value in the English language. It would never have been recognized. It wouldn't have been coined. Okay, that's where that word comes from. Okay, all three of them, they allow you to recognize it. See, so that's the challenge. The challenge is, can you get out of the fact finder rationalizer mode, like we were talking about last week? Can you begin to master yourself? Can you not let yourself take you off focus? Can you find focus in the first place? Okay, do you have enough insight to actually get focused in the first place? If you have, you know, it's sad to record that so few persons on your rancha really have the ability to focus. That's what it says, paper 16, section 6. Okay. Well, if you've managed to get some ability to focus, can you hold it for more than a split second? Before, you know, before the incessant clamoring of inescapable self wants to write a whole book about, you know, or something, you know, create a blog, you know, or whatever. I mean, can you hold the focus long enough to get it from recognition to realization? If you can't take it up to realization, you're wasting your time. It'll immediately melt away. You know, so you've got to do that. And the more you develop the ability to do this, you know, the more it happens just automatically. So you're reading along, you're recognizing, and you go, boom, wow. I just changed every thought I have about every paragraph in the book now. I see it all in a wholly new light. And I'm never going to see it the same way again. Okay? You can realize it just like that. Remember, it is the Father's gift, that the ability to realize, to grasp it with your personality. You know, not just see it with your personality, recognition, but grab it with your personality, faith grasp. You know, and the moment you do, it's eternal. If you actually grab it with your personality, okay, now it's with you eternally, and it changes everything. You'll never think about anything else again because it's impossible to think about anything else without that there. You can't get it out of your hand. It's always there now. And every other thing you think about, it changes everything. Okay? You can't close that eye ever again if you've gone to realization. If you've just gone to recognition, you can close your eye and it can melt away. Okay? You want to make it so the eye can never be closed again.
A lot of things are individual, and I know this might sound funny, but to me, imperfect works real well, because it just seems that the semantics seem to fit with the concepts that are being presented, And a lot of times, if I'm talking to other readers or even a new reader, and we might be talking about the purpose that we're here,
mm-hmm.
I think many times I've said, well, God brings us into existence imperfect and through a process of revelation and experience and evolution draws us towards perfection,
right.
And there's this long journey,
right.
And it just seems to be natural,
right? And you know factually that's the case, but you want to give that new person more than facts.
Just
stick with me for a second here. See, you're going to give him that, but you're going to give him something else first. Just like I am going to eventually, and I've spent a lot of time using my second adjutant to, get an understanding, related to this too. It isn't all just in that reflective mode. Once I have a firm grip on it reflectively, I engage it, and I create a solid rational picture. I've got to create a solid enough rational picture that I can conceive of analogies. So I can use analogies in the study group. I can help you to see the same picture. I've got to get that going at some point. Okay, I can't just stay up there in the temple. Okay, but that recognition comes first. So I mean, in truth, Chris, and it is it not the gospel? Is it not the good news? You are perfecting. Now, what that means factually is that. Right now, as a mere fact, you're imperfect. Face the facts and adjust them to ideals, and you'll achieve wisdom. Okay? But the only way that you can face that fact and adjust it to ideals instead of just having the dead fact staring you at the face, imperfect, okay? You got to have truth. You've got to have the truth of yourself first. Okay? If I have the truth that I'm perfecting, that's an ing word. There's something happening, functioning there, happening. I bet it could actually connect things together, like ideals to facts. Something that's dynamic and moving could actually have a process associated with it. It could make that help me with that connection. See, that's what you need. Remember what it says. After the cosmic introduced the cosmic fruits of the spirit. And they put two things together. As equals. The spirit of truth is not in you. You are dead. Notice how they're equating this. You're dead. You're not alive. You're not living. You're not moving. Okay? And God can't steer a parked car. Okay? God can't help you connect ideals to facts if your car is parked. Okay? Because you actually have to move between the two. The two are separated. God can't magically bring the two together so you don't have to move. So that you're just, innately wise. Okay? It takes effort to bridge that gap. Yeah. A couple more things, and then we'll bring in the infinite eternal ellipse.
On the Jesus, well, I guess we could look at Jesus, and you got me curious now because of this question. How did Jesus approach things? Did he just kind of leave them there and let them start themselves, or did he kind of give them a little push as well as identifying where they need to go? Did he kind of give them a little start?
Anytime that you are really flowing with the truth, there's no way to answer all the questions because the questions are forming faster than you can answer them in your mind. And that's the state you want to live in from here to eternity. A state where there's ever more questions, coming into recognition. The moment that you answer one, 15 more pop into recognition. And you go, oh, cool, because I answered those 15. And it's like if one lived at 15, 15 times 15 is, wow. See, you want it to start geometrically expanding, and to have the courage to just let the question marks become infinite in front of you. And you can hardly wait for eternity to be able to get your, get around to have the time to deal with all those. And you patiently just set about this incredible journey. Oh, let's go at this one. Okay, and I've got that one. Okay, now let's go at this one. And it's just an endless journey of discovery when there's nothing but question marks before you. How sad if you think that, well, that's the last I. It's dotted. Now I'm perfect.
Oh,
yeah. Wait, let's do Jason first. That's right, yeah.
Thank you. you.
Yep.
With the recognize, realize, appreciate, and what is it, love?
Love.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the recognize can be muddled in. First, says it, the only thing the human mind can do is discover, and that can be patience, recognize, interpret, or recognize, but discover, recognize, interpret, and choose.
Mm-hmm.
So you got those four last things of the six things.
Yeah, and that's the process. It's kind of, again, you know, towards your question, John, you know, just, you know, yeah. Well, I discovered it. I discovered this book.
Impatience.
You know, I mean, all right, I mean, you got to have patience, obviously. See, I can discover this book. Now I can start to recognize it as a revelation. See? And then what's next?
Recognize, realize.
No. In the ones you just get.
Okay.
Discover, recognize,
interpret.
Okay, my second adjective, like I said, see? What comes after recognize? Okay, then I bring in my second adjutant, you know, and I get a rational picture, interpret it, get it all, you know, laid out for my subjective mind to get a hold of, and then
I choose.
See? That's the way it works. Yeah. One more little thing, then let's do this.
So I wanted to explore why you think, or is there any indication why they brought this to us in English?
Well, I mean, you could certainly speculate a lot. I mean, it's you can almost in retrospect go, isn't it interesting that as we've continued to grow, things like the internet and whatnot have begun to create almost a global language now with English. That's kind of interesting. I wonder if that's related to why they chose English. Or you can go. I know a little bit about languages. I know that a lot of languages are kind of limited in their philosophical scope. English is a great, because it's, you know, it's polyglot.
It has the largest number of vocabulary words.
Right, see? Yep, see? Yeah, it's very handy because it has such an incredible breadth to it to draw upon. All right. For those of you who are listening online here, it's up on the website, the Perfecting Horizons website, under the writings, The Infinite Eternal Ellipse.
When did you put it up there?
Late this afternoon.
Oh, that's why.
Katie can start handing them out. Now, there's an infinite number of things to talk about here, and, you know, we're almost out of time, and that's appropriate. I don't want to talk about a lot of things. Yeah, you know, we're launching an eternal journey of discovery and using the infinite eternal ellipse here to have a way to really foster, you know, going from the recognition to getting your subjective mind wrapped around it and really understanding. It's like, you know, like we often have to create analogies in order to really be able to get our mind wrapped around. It's like, oh, okay, I can, you know, once you can picture it, it's like, okay, now I understand. It's like that. Okay. That's what this is for, to really help with that. Now, I don't know how many people in the room. I only printed 40. If there's people that can share, I can print more than that for next week. But everyone who can share, please share. Is that enough for everyone? Okay. As you're starting to hand out this, let me just say a couple things. So, just a little bit of orientation on this. Like I said, we're not going to go into any great depth here. Just get your initial bearings on it, and we'll delve endlessly into it in the future. So, you know, the heart of it, the core of it, you know, down there in the center, see, the functional levels, the seven functional levels of total deity, okay? When we developed total deity, you know, back a number of months ago, you know, we recognized that those seven levels wrap around and connect. And that's why at the beginning of total deity, the beginning of the paper deity in reality,
They said, you know, when you start to really try to think about this and follow our clues and do something with this paper, it would be helpful if you tried thinking of it in terms of an ellipse. You know, and you're going, huh? And they didn't explain it. you know, but we finally put that together. We figured out what the heck they were suggesting that we do. And you know, once you begin to, you know, really want to use that image, you realize you really need four circuits around the ellipse so that you can, you know, put everything in a nice coordinated way, really coordinate your essential knowledge here. Okay, and so just so that you know what we've got here, you've got this outer circuit. You can think of that as the individuality circuit. And then the next circuit in, that's the circuit of the functioning of the Paradise Trinity. That's the circuit of the Mother. And then the next circuit in, that's the circuit of the Father. And then that inner circuit, that's the unity circuit. See, so individuality, Mother, Father, unity. Okay. And you know, we went through all the in detail. Let me just, you know, quickly point them out. Remember how when we finally, you know, connected deity and reality with this list of seven levels in the forward, put the two together and finally figured out what it is they were wanting us to do, you know, that we recognized that those these 14 facets of deity that they had thrown out on the table for us, we were supposed to connect it with the 14 labels here. These self-contained, self-existent, those, there's two labels, etc. You know, these 14 facets of deity are tied to those 14 different labels. So, you know, the first functional level, self-contained deity, that's the universal one of infinity. And remember, we discovered there's a little bit of complexity to the universal one of infinity. That's otherwise known as the original. And the original has two sides. You know, so you've got, you know, the two sides of the universal one of infinity there in the stasis of deity. Self-existent deity, that's the infinite. Okay. Self-willed deity. Okay, so we're going around to the second functional level. Self-willed, that's the infinite one. Self-purposive deity, that's the deity absolute. You know, or in actual deity language, that's the infinite potential. Yeah, the rest of them I'll use the actual deity language there, rather than the individuality word. Self-personalized deity. Well, we know what that is. That's the deity facet called the Universal Father. Or from the individuality viewpoint, we call him the Universal Father also. We use the same designation for both the unity and the individuality designations. Self-personalized deity, that's the Universal Father. Divinely fraternal deity, that's the Son. Self-distributive deity, that's the Universal Creator. Divinely revealed deity, that's the Spirit. Self-expansive deity, that's the Universal Controller. I keep losing my place. And creature identified deity. That's the sevenfold. Self-experiential deity. That's the infinite upholder. Creature creator unifying deity. Yeah, we know what that is. That's the supreme. Self-projected deity. That's the infinite capacity. And time-space transcending deity, that's the ultimate. Okay, there you go, all the way around. So, in creating the whole ellipse of the four circuits, and you also have a statement in the book that the Trinity functions on all levels. See, so the Trinity has got to appear, somewhere on every level. You know, and you've got a whole circuit just for that. Trinity of absoluteness, the Trinity of ultimacy, Trinity of supremacy, that goes all the way around the circuit, okay? The Trinity functions on every level, it says. And like we talked about when we got to the end of total deity, you know, there you have it. The Father goes all the way around. The Mother goes all the way around. Okay? So that's the basics of, you know, of what's there.
Hey, are these counter-rotational?
It is kind of fun, too, when they tell you about where the seven super universes are around the circuit, lay this out like this, they're roughly in these same locations. Not exactly, but roughly. So that's kind of an interesting little coincidence.
Is it the master spirit that represents each one of them?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, super universe, you know, number seven where we are is down here, you know, coming around the southern bend, heading up there, you know, and number one is here. And, you know,
yes. In orientation, not for scale, right?
Just roughly in orientation, not even exactly in orientation, but roughly, you know.
You've got the infinite upholder twice.
I got it three times. One, two, three. Yeah, see, there's a bunch of complexities. We don't want to go into all that right now. That'll take a long time to explain all those various things. But there, I mean, but just get, you know, a little, let's use this tool one time tonight before we end to understand one of the statements they made in here that seemed pretty inscrutable. Okay, they said that whenever, wherever, and however the absolute level of deity functions, paradise, absolute values, and meanings are manifest. Okay, remember I mentioned the absolute is a tricky thing to finally get pinned down where it fits in the picture, you know, because it's just kind of a simple linear thing, at least it is a beginning understanding. If you got the finite here in the fifth level domain, you know, here's the supreme, here's the ultimate around sixth, seventh level domains. You know, your first thought, well, wouldn't the absolute come next? And you go, no, the absolute's over here. To get to there, you've got to bring in existential, remember. You're going to existential experiential deity when you get to God the Absolute, when you get to the Absolute. Or in the other way around, in the orientation of this sentence, see, for the Supreme to get to me, all it has to do is go like that. For the Ultimate to get to me, well, it has to go through the Supreme, but then it can get to me. For the Absolute to get to me, you know, the experiential face of the Absolute, it's got to go through paradise to get to me. See? If the Absolute, you know, level gets to me, if, you know, that deity function engages me, paradise, absolute values, and meanings are manifest because it had to go through the stasis of deity. It had to go through this level where you have the Paradise Isle and the Paradise Trinity. It had to go through there. See, in the, you know, paradise absolute, you know, Trinity of absoluteness. Okay, it had to go through that to get to me experientially. Okay. So, see, that's, you know, just a simple example of once you lay it all out, in there, you know, once you coordinate the essential knowledge, you can begin to quickly understand in very just straightforward factual ways many, many mind-bogglingly inscrutable initially sentences in the book. You're like, what in the world does that mean? Just that. Okay, that's not hard at all. I get that. Even I can figure out that. Okay, that I have to get from this one to this one going around like this, I got to go through that one. That's just a duh. It's going to pick up paradise, absolute values, and meanings as it goes through there and bring them with them. Okay, so that's one of the things that we'll do a lot now going forward. You know, we're going to do two things as we're going through this forward. One, you know, not in that you know what maybe was a little belabored, but you know, we're not going to totally go through it in that mode like we just did tonight. But we want to try to do the spirit of that, where we're thinking about it both in the, I'm a pretty new reader mode, but we also want to continue to build. You know, there's a number of you that have been working pretty earnestly for a number of years to try to build up enough relationship with the objective picture to start to think about it beyond that simple initial, superficial level of, well, this word, what does it mean? And, try to get beyond that. So we're going to do both, and we'll try to maintain a balance. We won't go intensely deep into the graduate level sort of engagement of it. We'll sort of, tease on the boundaries of it every once in a while. Probably if things come together sometime this fall, for those who want to really muster some serious courage, I'm going to do a graduate level seminar. We're going to get a classroom on campus, and where we can have a board and we can engage. We're going to do total deity for the initiated. Because there's a whole bunch more that we can go into than even we went to when we read Total Deity. As deep as that was, we can penetrate it a lot more, and you'll get a lot more out of it once you start to fill in some of the blanks that that aren't even in that Total Deity paper. So we're gonna leave that really heavy duty there. But we want to definitely, like this is sort of example. We're gonna do things like that where, let's understand that sentence. Let's not just go, well, I don't know what the heck they're really talking about. There's some fancy words, and let's just keep going. Let's see if we can find an easy understanding of some of those words. And you'll see the foreword has a number of really splendid little pithy sentences like that, okay, that seem pretty hard to penetrate, but they're really not. They're really not that hard. Once you have the coordinated essential knowledge to be able to think in the picture that they're writing in. They're not writing in that picture that is great confusion, still more confused and uncertain, conceptual poverty, much ideas. They're not writing in that. Okay? They said that there's nothing for them there. You've got to get yourself out of that. So we'll do that. Is there any other little tidbits you want to touch on before we wrap her up, or you want to call it uncle for the night?
It's a new uncle.
Okay, let's take a moment here.